tells the European Union that it will not ignore its red lines during the ongoing Vienna talks for the revival of the JCPOA. Germany's top diplomat and Ukraine's president play down U.S. warnings about an imminent Russian invasion of Ukraine. Plus, France's announcement of an upcoming military withdrawal from Mali prompts celebrations in the African country. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 agreement are engaged in intense negotiations to revive the landmark accord. Iran's foreign minister says it's time for the U.S. and the European side to show they're willing to reach an agreement by making political decisions quickly. Amir Abdullahian made a comment in a meeting with EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell and the EU coordinator in the Vienna talks, Enrique Mora. The Iranian minister said it had it not been for Iran's initiatives, the sides would not be as close to the deal as they are now. But he insisted that Tehran's red lines will be in place. Also in an interview with CNN, Amir Abdullahian said that the West, the United States in particular, is responsible for a possible failure of the talks.
Now we are at a very sensitive time, and the other side should be realistic. And if the talks fail, we believe that it is the Americans and the other side that are responsible for it. And the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown its seriousness and has shown that it really wants the deal to be done.
According to the top diplomat, Iran's demands, including a verifiable removal of all sanctions inconsistent with the 2015 agreement and guarantees for the fulfillment of commitments by other parties, are absolutely reasonable. The eighth round of negotiations to restore the deal is underway in the Austrian capital of Vienna. The political commentator Bijan Tavassily argues it's the United States that has to make political decisions in order to salvage the 2015 deal, not Iran.
But then we are now seeing signs of France, Germany, and Great Britain coming over to this side and telling the Americans that it's their turn to make some moves now. That's a very significant development. And I think that it depends on the strength of the Biden administration, whether they are able to really make those moves. That, I mean, the majority of the staffers in the White House know that the onus is on them now. But I'm not sure whether they're strong enough to push it through domestically, even in their own party, even while they see that this is the only way forward. And the impetus is now on the American side because, as you well know, oil and gas prices are at record highs now. And so this is contributing to an inflationary environment in the United States that is really putting pressure on Democratic candidates in the 2022 elections. And so the party of Joe Biden could be gone in the election if they don't make this deal.
The situation remains tense in eastern Ukraine amid renewed fighting between government troops and pro-Russia forces. Ukrainian military says that pro-Russia forces have opened fire on more than 20 settlements, killing two soldiers. Explosions have also been reported north of Donetsk City. A second exploded shell has been found on Russian territory near the border. A leader of pro-Russia forces in eastern Ukraine has ordered a full troop mobilization over fears of an offensive.
We should unite all our efforts. I call on my fellow countrymen, reservists, to report to mobilization officers. Today I have signed a decree on general mobilization. I call on all men in the Republic able to hold a weapon in their hands to stand up to protect your families, your children, wives and mothers. Together we will achieve the desired and necessary victory for us all. We will protect Donbas and all Russian people.
Pro-Russia forces in eastern Ukraine are continuing to evacuate residents of Donetsk and surrounding areas as several buses were seen leaving for Russia. The situation escalated a few days ago when both sides accused each other of violating a 2015 ceasefire. Russia has expressed concerns over the renewed clashes, describing the situation as potentially very dangerous. Moscow denies Western allegations that it's planning an invasion of Ukraine. A U.S. official says more than 40% of Russian forces on the Ukraine border are in an attack position, and Moscow has begun a campaign of destabilization. The British Prime Minister says the sanctions on Moscow will go much further than previously suggested in case Russia moves to invade Ukraine. Boris Johnson's warning that the UK and the US will cut off Russian companies' access to US dollars and British pounds if the Kremlin orders an attack on its neighbor. He says the move will hit Russia very hard. Johnson claims that Russia is planning the biggest war in Europe since 1945, but Germany and Ukraine have pushed back against dire predictions. At a G7 meeting, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said it's inappropriate to resort to guessing or assuming what will happen. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky also said that there is no need to panic. Well, we've also asked our Brussels correspondent, Jerome Hughes, what European lawmakers make of the flare-up of tensions between Russia and the West. Let's listen to him.
It's more or less the same line that the West has been pushing in recent weeks since this sort of crisis escalated. And what basically the European Union, the United States and the UK are saying is that Russia will effectively be cut off from the international financial system if there is an invasion of Ukraine. So, and it's that when we heard the debate being debated in the European Parliament, there were a sizable number of MEPs, members of the European Parliament, lawmakers, who were saying that this is just the wrong track to go down, that this constant anti-Russia rhetoric, which we've been seeing building up now for years and years, and these constant threats about the SWIFT system, which is, you know, effectively the international trading and currency system, to cut Russia off from SWIFT and so on. And it's the type of rhetoric that really has been unhelpful, according to many lawmakers. So we've seen an escalation in the threats. We've seen the likes of Joe Biden talking about making sure that the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project between Russia and Germany, that just will be scrapped if there's an invasion of Ukraine.
The Somali energy minister has angered top officials for signing a deal with a U.S. company to explore oil and gas off the country's coast. The office of President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed says the agreement is null and void. It also issued a decree banning any such agreements with foreign governments and entities during the election period. Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble has also dismissed the agreement as illegal and unacceptable. He says he'll do whatever is needed to protect national resources. Somalia is going through an election process that's more than a year overdue. It's also been marred by violence, including a Saturday attack in the central city of Beledweyne that killed 14 people. Now, elsewhere, joy and celebrations in Bamako, the capital of Mali, over a planned withdrawal of French troops. French President Emmanuel Macron says that his troops will leave Mali in an orderly fashion over 4 to 6 months. Mali's ruling junta insists that a pullout needs to happen without delay. Relations between the two countries deteriorated sharply after a Malian army seized power in a coup d'etat in 2020. France has some 5,000 troops deployed across the Sahel, the majority of them in Mali. Paris says its troops are tasked with fighting militants in the region, but Mali is saying that a former colonial power intends to partition the country. Now, academic and journalist Mustafa Fattori believes that the French military presence has worsened the security situation in Africa and will most likely continue to do so in the future, too.
I think the security situation in the Sahel region, extending from all the way to in the east to Sudan, is less stable, less secure than it was in 2013, when first France sent its troops to fight what it calls jihadists and terrorist groups. So the whole area has been I wouldn't say mainly because of the French military intervention, but that was a contributing factor. The whole area has been destabilized much worse than it was. The number of attacks by terrorist groups has increased and has been a trans-border problem, not only in Mali, but we have seen it in Niger, we have seen it in Burkina Faso especially, where there has been a recent military takeover, mainly for this reason of lack of security. So the same problem is existing in Chad in a different form, and then all the way to Sudan, probably the contagion, the effect will continue.
Nearly 1 month into Canada's protest against COVID restrictions, police saying that significant progress has been made in removing protesters from the streets of the capital, Ottawa.
Today we've made some very important progress in safely removing this unlawful protest from our streets. At every step in this operation, we've been upfront and clear with the unlawful protesters that they must leave the area. We've advised them of our enforcement's efforts so they could continue to make informed decisions. We've backed up those warnings with a deliberate and methodical operation using lawful and safe tactics. At every step, they faced a barrage of resistance, shoving and vigilance.
Well, the official added that police at some point had to use horses, helmets, and batons to secure the safety of officers. Ottawa Police Chief also urged all the protesters remaining on the streets to go back home. Police clashed with protesters in the city earlier in the day using pepper sprays and stun grenades to disperse them. So far, more than 140 people have been arrested and dozens of vehicles seized over the past 2 days. Organizers of the so-called Freedom Convoy say they've asked truckers to withdraw because of the heavy-handed police tactics. The massive crackdown comes after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to deal with the situation. The demonstrations initially started in January by truckers who are opposed to rules that require unvaccinated cross-border drivers to quarantine. The protests, however, turned into a rallying point for all people who are in some way opposed to the policies of Trudeau's government. A political commentator, Kenneth Stone, argues that the protests in Canada are fueled by separatists in the country and provided for by supporters of former U.S. President Donald Trump's backers and allies.
Well, I have three things to say about the so-called Freedom Convoy. It has nothing to do with freedom. This protest was inspired by the former U.S. President Trump, Donald Trump, who subjected the Islamic Republic of Iran to a campaign of maximum pressure during his entire term of office. And he has encouraged and applauded this, so have some of his Republican governors in Texas and Florida, for example. He's encouraged people in the United States to give money, his supporters, and they have given a large part of the funding that went into this protest. In addition, the money comes as well from evangelical Christians in the United States. So the protest is not about freedom, and it is a right-wing fringe group that is leading these protests. This is their second convoy. They had one in 2019, and it was led by a woman, the same woman who was just arrested yesterday, and she belongs to a Western separatist party, which wants to break away Canada's Western provinces and join them with the United States.
Now, in Brazil, search and rescue operations go on as nearly 200 people are still unaccounted for in the wake of devastating floods and landslides. Rescue workers pulled more bodies Saturday from the Mati wreckage and rubble in the city of Petropolis, where the death toll has risen to 146. Bad weather hampered the search for survivors, and emergency teams had to suspend their work several times. Over 900 people have been housed in the schools and shelters. With a search in its fifth day, authorities say there is little hope of finding any more survivor. Teams of volunteers are also helping with the search and rescue. Tuesday's rainfall exceeded the average for the whole February, triggering landslides and floods in Petropolis. That's a popular tourist getaway north of Rio. Atlantic Storm Eunice has battered northwestern Europe. It hit western England Friday, powering its way all the way to capital London, killing more than a dozen people and leaving behind a trail of destruction. The storm has since dissipated and a cleanup operation is underway, but it has fueled a debate about the UK's resilience against such incidents. Saeed Porza reports from London.
Cleaning up the mess left behind by Storm Eunice that battered the UK this week. With record speeds of nearly 200 kilometers per hour, much of the country from Scotland to England felt the force of the storm's temper. Footage posted to social media showed trees fall, history be realigned, railway travel disrupted, planes struggling to land, iconic landmarks damaged. The capital, London, issued its first ever rat severe weather warning. Here, too, authorities asked residents not to leave home.
So the message to Londoners is, whilst the Met Office has the red weather warning, stay indoors. A storm Eunice is the worst storm we've faced in three decades. It's really important we don't inadvertently put ourselves in harm's way by being outdoors.
Many heeded the warning and stayed home. Others did not. Three people were killed.
One of those killed, a woman in her 30s, traveling in a car with a man of the same age here in North London when the tree fell onto their vehicle, killing her but sparing her partner.
Eunice knocked out electricity for tens of thousands of households on its path. The government had already been warned that the UK lacks the resilience to deal with storms, particularly in terms of electricity infrastructure. Here in London, there is a sense of worry about what's to come next.
I guess you're just not really used to it happening, and I guess it's just one of those things that's going to happen more often, and we need to do more to be prepared to deal with them.
I'd say it's quite concerning because it kind of makes me think of the bigger picture of where the entire climate is headed, where we're headed as a species. Everything was just in disarray. It was crazy and chaotic, and I know a lot of people felt scared.
Eunice was predicted to be the first storm in 30 years and certainly won't be the last. The clear-up phase is well underway now, but the wider debate about the state of the UK's resilience against storms is only just gathering pace. Saeed Porza, London.
And that brings us to the end of this broadcast from Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Welcome back to Aperture. We follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild rue plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, these perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country, and their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world, and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years. Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Isfandiyar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens. The lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and the very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Isfandiyar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Isfandiyar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a schoolteacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Isfandiyar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Isfandiyar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Isfandiyar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people, too, hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great, because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain. But there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems. But Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Esfandiar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, the quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Esfandiyar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Esfandiyar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Perhaps next time you enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Isfandiar and the kind and hard-working farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles.
stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Education is a very, very tricky, very sensitive field. Perhaps the trickiest and the sensitivest, the most sensitive. My education has just proven very questionable, of course. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a hadith about it being the profession of the Anbiya. And Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam wouldn't have constantly been referred to in the riwayat and the ayat as a teacher, compared to one at least. Because that's basically what he does, right? He's a ma'allim. He teaches us about the ayat and the... And he is the one who cleanses our soul. يُزَكِّي يُعَلِّمُهُمُ الْكِتَابَ وَيُزَكِّيهِمْ This and that. The ability to train a human being, the ability to train any living creature, really. I have much respect for people who can train animals without abusing them. I think it's very cool if the animal is actually enjoying it, of course. Otherwise, it's animal abuse. The ability to have that degree of patience and insight and passion and enthusiasm to be able to train a living creature and help it tap into that hidden potential and do more than what it is comfortable doing. That works better with human beings because they've got that higher degree of intelligence and consciousness. With animals, maybe they weren't created to do that most of the times. Anyway, besides the point. And then there's monks, you know. Monks, they take on a great degree of teaching and training. And let's listen to a story about that, and we'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salamu alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. The right teaching is the title of today's story. Once there was a renowned monk who lived in a beautiful with many of his pupils. His teachings were known to be very effective and many of his students grew up to become great masters themselves. One day, one of them was caught stealing from his fellow students and they reported him to the monk, but he took no action against the boy. A few days later, the same boy was again caught stealing, and again the head monk did nothing to punish him. This angered the other students, who drew up a petition asking for the dismissal of the thief. The teacher called a meeting of the students. When they had assembled, he said to them, "You are good boys who know what is right and what is wrong. If you leave, you will have no trouble in joining some other school. But what about your brother, who does not even know the difference between right and wrong? Who will teach him if I don't? No, I can't ask him to go even if it means losing all of you." Tears coursed down the cheeks of the boy who had stolen. He never stole again and in later life became renowned for his integrity. Famous quote from Mark Van Doren, "The art of teaching is the art of assisting discovery."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Parents have such a crucial, sensitive, significant, and unimaginably risky job to do. It's such a risky job. If we don't, as parents, as guardians, as trainers, and as teachers, educate ourselves enough, train ourselves and our nafs enough, we will end up doing more damage to those under our care, under our training, and we will end up perhaps changing the course of the world, the course of history, because we couldn't be bothered to first refine ourselves and make ourselves better people before venturing out to train other human beings. Often we see parents popping out children as if I don't know what. I mean, you want to buy a car, you do more research. You want to buy a puppy, you at least you read a few articles on the internet. Yet we so easily bring about another human life into this world without having any clue about how this human being functions, how I function as a human being to begin with, and what I want to impart onto this mini human. So I end up just imprinting my own traumas and my own insecurities and my own personality complexes and dysfunctionalities onto the next generation. And it takes so much effort and time and extra education for that cycle to break and for a single link in this chain to go, like, you know, to come to this realization and awareness that, you know what, this has got to stop. It's crazy. It's getting out of hand. It's just so sad when we see that happening. The degree of flexibility and patience and understanding, the degree of expansion of chest, as the Quran constantly says, that a trainer must have in order to be able to influence those under their care in a positive and constructive way. Nabi Musa alayhi salam, ala nabina wa alayhi salam, was tasked with the responsibility to go up to the tyrant of his time and remind him or teach him or give him a wake-up call or whatever and tell him that, well, bro, you got to stop whatever it is that you're doing because it's going to end up, you're going to end up in hell and those around you are going to end up in hell. And I'm here to warn you and tell you to stop because this is not what you were created for, right? Nabi Musa alayhi salam was about to face the tyrant of his time. Like, dude killed people for pleasure at this point in his life. He killed people maybe not for pleasure, but just because he could. Oh, this certain random kid from the Jews is gonna grow up one day and threaten my throne. Well, I can and I will make sure that child is killed before he grows up. You get the point? And Nabi Musa is about to go hit this guy up and talk to him. And he asks for what? From Allah, Rabbi Shrahli Sadri. Expand my chest. Give me patience. Give me tolerance. Forbearance. I don't lose my cool. I can talk this out with the guy. That's how important it is to be tolerant of the imperfections and the struggles of those whom we are training. And I hope we really understand the gravity of that. Myself before any other. And that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for being with us.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu al-qulub.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.